to Berlin. The destroyed city fired an uneasy burst of associations. Then we went on to Berlin and saw absolute ruin. Hitler's folly. He overreached himself by trying to take in too much territory. He had no morals, and his people backed him up. Never did I see a more sorrowful sight, nor witness retribution to the nth degree. I thought of Carthage, Baalbek, Jerusalem, Rome, Atlantis, Peking, Babylon, Nineveh, Scipio, Ramses II, Titus, Hermann, Sherman, Genghis Khan, Alexander, Darius the Great. But Hitler only destroyed Stalingrad and Berlin. I hope for some sort of peace, but I fear that machines are ahead of morals by some centuries, and when morals catch up, perhaps there will be no reason for any of it. I hope not, but we are only termites on a planet, and maybe when we bore too deeply into the planet, there will be a reckoning. Who knows? The proposed program for Japan that Stimson had offered to Truman on July 2nd had reckoned up that country's situation, which included the possible entry of the Soviet Union, at present neutral, into the Pacific War, and judged it desperate. Japan has no allies. Her navy is nearly destroyed, and she is vulnerable to a surface and underwater blockade which can deprive her of sufficient food and supplies for her population. She is terribly vulnerable to our concentrated air attack upon her crowded cities, industrial and food resources. She has against her not only the Anglo-American forces, but the rising forces of China and the ominous threat of Russia. We have inexhaustible and untouched industrial resources to bring to bear against her diminishing potential. We have great moral superiority through being the victim of her first sneak attack. On the other hand, Stimson had argued, because of the mountainous Japanese terrain, and because the Japanese are highly patriotic and certainly susceptible to calls for fanatical resistance to repel an invasion, America would probably have to go through with an even more bitter Finnish fight than in Germany, if it attempted to invade. Was there then any alternative? Stimson thought there might be. I believe Japan is susceptible to reason in such a crisis to a much greater extent than is indicated by our current press and other current comment. Japan is not a nation composed wholly of mad fanatics of an entirely different mentality from ours. On the contrary, she has, within the past century, shown herself to possess extremely intelligent people, capable in an unprecedentedly short time of adopting not only the complicated technique of Occidental civilization, but to a substantial extent their culture and their political and social ideas. Her advance in these respects has been one of the most astounding feats of national progress in history. It is therefore my conclusion that a carefully timed warning be given to Japan. I personally think that if, in giving such a warning, we should add that we do not exclude a constitutional monarchy under her present dynasty, it would substantially add to the chances of acceptance. Within the text of his proposal, the Secretary of War several times characterized it as the equivalent of an unconditional surrender, but others did not see it so. Before Burns left for Potsdam, he had carried the document to ailing Cordell Hull, a fellow Southerner and Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of State from 1933 to 1944, and Hull had immediately plucked out the concession to the present dynasty, the Emperor Hirohito, in whose mild, myopic figure many Americans had personified Japanese militarism, and told Burns that the statement seemed too much like appeasement of Japan. It may have been, but by the time they arrived in Potsdam, Stimson, Truman, and Burns had learned that it was also the minimum condition of surrender the Japanese were prepared to countenance, whatever their desperate situation. U.S. intelligence had intercepted and decoded messages passing between Tokyo and Moscow, instructing Japanese Ambassador Naotake Sato to attempt to interest the Soviets in mediating a Japanese surrender. The foreign and domestic situation for the Empire is very serious, Foreign Minister Shigenori Togo had cabled Sato on July 11th, and even the termination of the war is now being considered privately. We are also sounding out the extent to which we might employ the USSR in connection with the termination of the war. This is a matter with which the Imperial Court is greatly concerned. And pointedly, on July 12th, it is His Majesty's heart's desire to see the swift termination of the war. However, as long as America and England insist on unconditional surrender, our country has no alternative but to see it through in an all-out effort for the sake of survival and the honor of the homeland. Unconditional surrender seemed to the Japanese leadership a demand to give up its essential and historic polity, a demand that under similar circumstances, Americans also might hesitate to meet, even at the price of their lives. Hence Stimson's careful qualification of his proposed terms of surrender. But to the extent that the imperial institution was tainted with militarism, an offer to preserve it might also seem an offer to preserve the militaristic government that ran the country and that had started and pursued the war. Certainly many Americans might think so and might conclude in consequence that their wartime sacrifices were being callously betrayed. Hull considered these difficulties while Burns sailed the Atlantic and sent along a cable of further advice on July 16th. The Japanese might reject a challenge to surrender, the former Secretary of State argued, even if it allowed the emperor to remain on the throne. In that case, not only would the militarists among them be encouraged by what they would take to be a sign of weakening Allied will, but also terrible political repercussions would follow in the U.S. Would it be all well first to await the climax of Allied bombing and Russia's entry into the war? The point of warning the Japanese was to encourage an early surrender in the hope of avoiding a bloody invasion. The trouble with waiting until the Soviet Union entered the war was that it left Truman where he had dangled uncomfortably for months, over Stalin's barrel, dependent on the USSR for military intervention in Manchuria to tie up the Japanese armies there. Hull's delaying tactic might improve the first prospect, but it might also secure the second. Another message arrived in Potsdam that evening, however, that changed the terms of the equation. A message for Stimson from George Harrison in Washington, announcing the success of the Trinity shot. Operated on this morning. Diagnosis not yet complete, but results seem satisfactory and already exceed expectations. Local press release is necessary as interest extends great distance. Dr. Groves, pleased. He returns tomorrow. I will keep you posted. Well, Stimson remarked to Harvey Bundy with relief, I have been responsible for spending $2 billions of dollars on this atomic venture. Now that it is successful, I shall not be sent to prison in Fort Leavenworth. Happily, the Secretary of War carried the cable to Truman and Burns, just returned to Potsdam from Berlin. In Stimson's welcome news, Burns saw a more general reprieve. It informed his overnight response to Hull. The following day, Hull says, I received a message from Secretary Burns agreeing that the statement warning the Japanese should be delayed and that, when it was issued, it should not contain this commitment with regard to the Emperor. Burns had good reason to delay a warning now, to await the readying of the first combat atomic bombs. Those weapons would answer Hull's first objection. If the Japanese ignored a warning, then the United States could deliver a brutally retributive response. With such weapons in the U.S. arsenal, unconditional surrender need not be compromised. And America no longer required the Soviet Union's aid in the Pacific. The problem now would not be dealing the Soviets in, but stalling to keep them out. Neither the President nor I, Burns affirms, were anxious to have them enter the war after we had learned of this successful test. Burns and others within the American delegation came to realize that preserving the emperor might be sensible policy If Hirohito alone could persuade the far-flung Japanese armies, undefeated and with a year's supply of ammunition on hand, to lay down their arms. The new Secretary of State, who was drafting a suitable declaration, sought a formula that would not arouse the American people but might reassure the Japanese. The Joint Chiefs produced its first version. Subject to suitable guarantees against further acts of aggression, the Japanese people will be free to choose their own form of government. The Japanese polity resided in the imperial house, not in the people, but provision for popular government was as conditional and unconditional surrender as the enemy would be allowed. George Harrison cabled Stimson on July 21st that all your local military advisors engaged in preparation definitely favor your pet city. Groves still coveted Kyoto. Stimson quickly returned that he was aware of no factors to change my decision. On the contrary, new factors here tend to confirm it. Harrison also asked Stimson to alert him by July 25th if there is any change in plans, because the patient is progressing rapidly. At the same time, Groves requested permission from George Marshall to brief Douglas MacArthur, who had not yet been told about the new weapon, in view of the imminence of the use of the atomic fission bomb in operations against Japan 5 to 10 August. The 509th had begun flying pumpkin missions over Japan the previous day for combat experience and to accustom the enemy to small, unescorted flights of B-29s at high altitude. Groves' eyewitness narrative of the Trinity test had arrived that Saturday just before noon. Stimson sought out Truman and Burns and had the satisfaction of riveting them to their chairs by reading it aloud. Groves estimated the energy generated to be in excess of the equivalent of 15,000 to 20,000 tons of TNT, and allowed his deputy, Thomas F. Farrell, to call the visual effects unprecedented, magnificent, beautiful, stupendous, and terrifying. Kenneth Bainbridge's foul and awesome display became, at Farrell's hand, that beauty the great poets dream about, but describe most poorly and inadequately, which Farrell presumably meant for a superlative. As to the present war, Farrell opined, there was a feeling that no matter what else might happen, we now had the means to ensure its speedy conclusion and save thousands of American lives. Stimson saw that Truman was tremendously pepped up by the report. He said it gave him an entirely new feeling of confidence. The president met the next day to discuss Groves' results with Burns, Stimson, and the Joint Chiefs, including Marshall and Hap Arnold. Arnold had long maintained that conventional strategic bombing by itself could compel the Japanese to surrender. In late June, when invasion was being decided, he had rushed LeMay to Washington to work the numbers. LeMay figured he could complete the destruction of the Japanese war machine by October 1st. In order to do this, writes Arnold, he had to take care of some 30 to 60 large and small cities. Between May and August, LeMay took care of 58. But Marshall disagreed with the Air Force assessment. The situation in the Pacific, he told Truman in June, was practically identical to the situation in Europe after Normandy. Air power alone was not sufficient to put the Japanese out of the war. It was unable alone to put the Germans out. He explained his reasoning at Potsdam to an interviewer after the war. We regarded the matter of dropping the atomic bomb as exceedingly important. We had just gone through a bitter experience at Okinawa, the last major island campaign, when the Americans lost more than 12,500 men killed and missing, and the Japanese more than 100,000 killed in 82 days of fighting. This had been preceded by a number of similar experiences in other Pacific islands north of Australia. The Japanese had demonstrated in each case they would not surrender, and they would fight to the death. It was expected that resistance in Japan, with their home ties, would be even more severe. We had the 100,000 people killed in Tokyo in one night of conventional bombs, and it had seemingly no effect whatsoever. It destroyed the Japanese cities, yes, but their morale was not affected, as far as we could tell, not at all. So it seemed quite necessary, if we could, to shock them into action. We had to end the war. We had to save American lives. Before Groves's report arrived, Dwight Eisenhower, a hard and pragmatic commander, had angered Stimson with a significantly different assessment. We'd had a nice evening together at headquarters in Germany, the Supreme Allied Commander remembers. Nice dinner, everything was fine. Then Stimson got this cable saying the bomb had been perfected and was ready to be dropped. The cable was the second Harrison had sent, the day after the Trinity test, when Groves arrived back in Washington. Doctor has just returned most enthusiastic and confident that the little boy is as husky as his big brother. The light in his eyes discernible from here to Highhold, and I could have heard his screams from here to my farm. Highhold was Stimson's Long Island estate, 250 miles from Washington. The Trinity flash had been visible even farther from zero than that. Harrison's farm was 50 miles outside the capital. Eisenhower found the allegorical code less than amusing, and the subject baleful. The cable was in code, you know the way they do it, the lamb is born or some damn thing like that. So then he told me they were going to drop it on the Japanese. Well, I listened, and I didn't volunteer anything because after all my war was over in Europe, and it wasn't up to me. But I was getting more and more depressed just thinking about it. Then he asked for my opinion. So I told him I was against it on two counts. First, the Japanese were ready to surrender, and it wasn't necessary to hit them with that awful thing. Second, I hated to see our country be the first to use such a weapon. Well, the old gentleman got furious, and I can see how he would. After all, it had been his responsibility to push for all the huge expenditure to develop the bomb, which of course he had a right to do, and was right to do. Still, it was an awful problem. Eisenhower also spoke to Truman, but the president concurred in Marshall's judgment, having already formed his own. "Believe Japs will fold up before Russia comes in," he confided to his diary almost as soon as he heard of the Trinity success. "I am sure they will when Manhattan appears over their homeland." When to issue the Potsdam Declaration now became essentially a question of when the first atomic bombs would be ready to be dropped. Stimson queried Harrison, who responded on July 23rd. "Operation may be possible any time from August 1st, depending on state of preparation of patient and condition of atmosphere. From point of view of patient only, some chance August 1st to 3rd, good chance August 4th to 5th, and barring unexpected relapse, almost certain before August 10th. Stimson had also asked for a target list, always excluding the particular place against which I have decided. My decision has been confirmed by highest authority. Harrison complied. Hiroshima, Kokura, Niigata, in order of choice, here. Which meant that Nagasaki had not yet, as of the last full week in July, been added to the list. Within days, it would be. Official Air Force historians speculate that LeMay's staff proposed it. The requirement for visual bombing was probably the reason. Hiroshima was 440 miles southwest of Niigata. Nagasaki, over the mountains from Kokura or Kyushu, was a further 220 miles southwest of Hiroshima. If one city was socked in, another might be clear. Nagasaki was certainly also added because it was one of the few major cities left in Japan that had not yet been burned out. A revealing third cable completed the day's communications from Harrison. The metallurgists at Los Alamos had finished the PU core for Fat Man that day. It concerned possible future deliveries of atomic bombs and hinted at a forthcoming change in design, probably to the so-called mixed implosion bomb, with a core of U-235 and plutonium alloyed together. Such a core could draw on the resources of both Oak Ridge and Hanford. "First one of tested type, that is, Fat Man, Should be ready at Pacific Base around 6 August. Second one ready about 24 August. Additional ones ready at accelerating rate from possibly 3 in September to, we hope, 7 or more in December. The increased rate above 3 per month entails changes in design, which Groves believes thoroughly sound. Stimson reported Harrison's several estimates to Truman on Tuesday morning, July 24th. The president was pleased and said he would use them to time the release of the Potsdam Declaration. The secretary took advantage of the moment to appeal to Truman to consider assuring the Japanese privately that they could keep their emperor if they persisted in making that concession a condition of surrender. Deliberately noncommittal, the president said he had the point in mind and would take care of it. Stimson left, and Burns joined Truman for lunch. They discussed how to tell Stalin as little as possible about the atomic bomb. Truman wanted protective cover when Stalin learned that his wartime allies had developed an epical new weapon behind his back, but wanted to give as little as possible away. Burns also devised a more immediate reason for circumspection. He told the historian Herbert Feiss in 1958. As a result of his experience with the Russians during the first week of the conference, he had come to the conclusion that it would be regrettable if the Soviet Union entered the Pacific War, and he was afraid that if Stalin were made fully aware of the power of the new weapon, he might order the Soviet army to plunge forward at once. But in fact, Stalin already knew about the Trinity test. His agents in the United States had reported it to him. It appears he was not immediately impressed. There is gallows humor in Truman's elaborately offhand approach to the Soviet premier at the end of that day's plenary session at the Kecilianhof Palace, stripped and shabby, where pale German mosquitoes homing through unscreened windows dined on the sanguinary conquerors. Truman left behind his translator, rounded the baize-covered conference table, and sidled up to his Soviet counterpart, both men dissimulating. I casually mentioned to Stalin that we had a new weapon of unusual destructive force. The Russian premier showed no special interest. All he said was that he was glad to hear it, and hoped we would make good use of it against the Japanese. That, concludes Robert Oppenheimer dryly, knowing how much at that moment the world lost, was carrying casualness rather far. If Stalin was not yet impressed with the potential of the bomb, Truman, in his private diary, was waxing apocalyptic, biblical visions mingling in his autodidact's mind with doubt that the atom could be decomposed and denial that the new weapon would be used to slaughter civilians. We have discovered the most terrible bomb in the history of the world. It may be the fire destruction prophesied in the Euphrates Valley era after Noah and his fabulous ark. Anyway, we think we have found a way to cause a disintegration of the atom. An experiment in the New Mexican desert was startling, to put it mildly. This weapon is to be used against Japan between now and August 10th. I have told the Secretary of War, Mr. Stimson, to use it so that military objectives and soldiers and sailors are the target and not women and children. Even if the Japs are savage, ruthless, merciless, and fanatic, we as the leader of the world for the common welfare cannot drop this terrible bomb on the old capital or the new. He and I are in accord. The target will be a purely military one. And we will issue a warning statement asking the Japs to surrender and save lives. I'm sure they will not do that, but we will have given them the chance. It is certainly a good thing for the world that Hitler's crowd, or Stalin's, did not discover this atomic bomb. It seems to be the most terrible thing ever discovered, but it can be made the most useful. The Tuesday Truman mentioned the new weapon to Stalin, the combined chiefs met with their Soviet counterparts. Red Army Chief of Staff General Alexei E. Antonov announced that Soviet troops were assembling on the Manchurian border and would be ready to attack in the second half of August. Stalin had said August 15th before. Burns was anxious that the Soviets might prove uncharacteristically punctual. That afternoon in Washington, Groves drafted the historic directive releasing the atomic bomb to use. It passed up through Harrison for transmission by radio eyes only to Marshall, in order that your approval and the Secretary of War's approval might be obtained as soon as possible. A small map of Japan, cut from a large National Geographic Society map, and a one-page description of the chosen targets, which now included Nagasaki, followed by courier. Marshall and Stimson approved the directive at Potsdam, and presumably showed it to Truman, though it does not record his formal authorization. It went out the next morning to the new commander of the Strategic Air Force for the Pacific. To General Carl Spatz, CG, USA, STAF. 1. The 509 Composite Group 20th Air Force will deliver its first special bomb as soon as weather will permit visual bombings after about 3 August 1945 on one of the targets, Hiroshima, Kokura, Niigata, and Nagasaki. 2. Additional bombs will be delivered on the above targets as soon as made ready by the project staff. 3. Dissemination of any and all information concerning the use of the weapon against Japan is reserved to the Secretary of War and the President of the United States. 4. The foregoing directive is issued to you by direction and with the approval of the Secretary of War and of the Chief of Staff, USA. As Groves drafted the directive, the metallurgists at Los Alamos finished casting the rings of U-235 that fitted together to form the gun bomb's target assembly, the last components needed to complete Little Boy. Strategy and delivery intersected on July 26th and synchronized. The Indianapolis arrived at Tinian. 3 Air Transport Command C-54 cargo planes departed Kirtland Air Force Base with the 3 separate pieces of the Little Boy target assembly. 2 more ATC C-54s departed with Fat Man's initiator and plutonium core. Meanwhile, Truman's staff released the Potsdam Declaration to the press at 7 p.m. for dispatch from occupied Germany at 9:20. It offered, on behalf of the President of the United States, the President of Nationalist China, and the Prime Minister of Great Britain, to give Japan an opportunity to end this war. The following are our terms. We will not deviate from them. There are no alternatives. We shall brook no delay. There must be eliminated for all time the authority and influence of those who have deceived and misled the people of Japan into embarking on world conquest. Until such a new order is established, points in Japanese territory shall be occupied. Japanese sovereignty shall be limited to the islands of Honshu, Hokkaido, Kyushu, Shikoku, and such minor islands as we determine. The Japanese military forces, after being completely disarmed, shall be permitted to return to their homes with the opportunity to lead peaceful and productive lives. We do not intend that the Japanese shall be enslaved as a race or destroyed as a nation, but stern justice shall be meted out to all war criminals. Freedom of speech, of religion, and of thought, as well as respect for the fundamental human rights, shall be established. Japan shall be permitted to maintain such industries as will sustain her economy. The occupying forces of the Allies shall be withdrawn from Japan as soon as these objectives have been accomplished, and there has been established, in accordance with the freely expressed will of the Japanese people, a peacefully inclined and responsible government. We call upon the government of Japan to proclaim now the unconditional surrender of all Japanese armed forces. The alternative for Japan is prompt and utter destruction. We faced a terrible decision, Burns wrote in 1947. We could not rely on Japan's inquiries to the Soviet Union about a negotiated peace as proof that Japan would surrender unconditionally without the use of the bomb. In fact, Stalin stated the last message to him had said that Japan would fight to the death rather than accept unconditional surrender. Under the circumstances, agreement to negotiate could only arouse false hopes. Instead, we relied upon the Potsdam Declaration. The text of that somber document went out by radio to the Japanese from San Francisco. Japanese monitors picked it up at 0700 hours Tokyo time July 27th. The Japanese leaders debated its mysteries all day. A quick Foreign Office analysis noted for the ministers that the Soviet Union had preserved its neutrality by not sponsoring the declaration, that it specified what the Allies meant by unconditional surrender, and that the term itself had been applied specifically only to the nation's armed forces. Foreign Minister Togo disliked the demand for occupation and the stripping away of Japan's foreign possessions. He recommended waiting for a Soviet response to Ambassador Sato's representations before responding. The Prime Minister, Baron Kantaro Suzuki, came during the day to the same position. The military leaders disagreed. They recommended immediate rejection. Anything less, they argued, might impair morale. The next day, Japanese newspapers published a censored version of the Potsdam text, leaving out, in particular, the provision allowing disarmed military forces to return peacefully to their homes, and the assurance that the Japanese would not be enslaved or destroyed. In the afternoon, Suzuki held a press conference. "I believe the joint proclamation by the three countries," he told reporters, "is nothing but a rehash of the Cairo Declaration. As for the government, it does not find any important value in it, and there is no other recourse but to ignore it entirely and resolutely fight for the successful conclusion of the war." In Japanese, Suzuki said there was no other recourse but to mokusatsu the declaration, which could also mean treat it with silent contempt. Historians have debated for years which meaning Suzuki had in mind, but there can hardly be any doubt about the rest of his statement. Japan intended to fight on. "In the face of this rejection," Stimson explained in Harper's in 1947, "we can only proceed to demonstrate that the ultimatum had meant exactly what it said when it stated that if the Japanese continued the war, the full application of our military power, backed by our resolve, will mean the inevitable and complete destruction of the Japanese armed forces, and just as inevitably, the utter devastation of the Japanese homeland." For such a purpose, the atomic bomb was an eminently suitable weapon. The night of Suzuki's press conference, the five C-54s from Albuquerque arrived at Tinian, 6,000 miles nearer Japan, while three B-29s departed Kirtland, each carrying a Fat Man high-explosive pre-assembly. The U.S. Senate, in the meantime, ratified the United Nations Charter. The Indianapolis had sailed on to Guam after unloading the little boy gun and bullet at Tinian on July 26th. From Guam, it continued unescorted toward Leyte in the Philippines, where 2 weeks of training would ready the crew, 1,196 men, to join Task Force 95 at Okinawa, preparing for the November 1 Kyushu invasion. With the destruction of the Japanese surface fleet and air force, unescorted sailing had become commonplace on courses through rear areas. But the Indianapolis, an older vessel, lacked sonar gear for submarine detection and was top-heavy. Japanese submarine I-58 discovered the heavy cruiser in the Philippine Sea a little before midnight on Sunday, July 29th, and mistook it for a battleship. Easily avoiding detection while submerging to periscope depth, I-58 fired a fanwise salvo of six torpedoes from 1,500 yards. Lieutenant Commander Mochitsura Hashimoto, I-58's commanding officer, remembers the result. "I took a quick look through the periscope, but there was nothing else in sight. Bringing the boat onto a course parallel with the enemy, we waited anxiously. Every minute seemed an age. Then on the starboard side of the enemy, by the forward turret, and then by the after turret, there rose columns of water, to be followed immediately by flashes of bright red flame. Then another column of water rose from alongside number one turret and seemed to envelop the whole ship. "A hit! A hit!" I shouted as each torpedo struck home, and the crew danced round with joy. Soon came the sound of a heavy explosion, far greater than that of the actual hits. Three more heavy explosions followed in quick succession, then six more. The torpedoes and following explosions of ammunition and aviation fuel ripped away the cruiser's bow and destroyed its power center. Without power, the radio officer was unable to send a distress signal. He went through the motions anyway, or the bridge to communicate with the engine room. The engines pushed the ship forward unchecked, scooping up water through the holes in the hull and leaving behind the sailors thrown overboard who had been sleeping on deck in the tropical heat. The order to abandon ship, when it came, had to be passed by word of mouth. With the ship listing to 45 degrees, frightened and injured men struggled to follow disaster drill. Fires lit the darkness, and smoke sickened. The ship's medical officer found some 30 seriously burned men in their port hangar where the aviation fuel had exploded. At best, they got morphine for their screams and rough Kapok life jackets strapped over their burns. They went overboard with the others into salt water scummed with nauseating fuel oil. It was possible to walk down the hull to the keel and jump into the water, but the spinning number three screw with its lethal blades chopped to death the unwary. Some 850 men escaped. The stern rose up 100 feet straight into the air, and the ship plunged. The survivors heard screams from within the disappearing hull. Then they were left to the night and the darkness in 12-foot swells. Most had Kapok life jackets. Few had found their way to life rafts. They floated instead in clusters, linked together, stronger men swimming the circumferences to catch sleepers before they drifted away. One group numbered between 300 and 400 souls. They pushed the wounded to the center, where the water was calmer, and prayed the distress call had gone out. The captain had found 2 empty life rafts, and later that night encountered 1 more occupied. He ordered the rafts lashed together. They sheltered 10 men, and he thought them the only survivors. Through the night, a current carried the swimmers southwest, while wind blew the rafts northeast. By the light of morning, rafts and swimmers had separated beyond discovery. More than 50 injured swimmers died during the night. Their comrades freed them from their jackets in the morning and let them go. The wind abated and the sun glared from the oil slick, blinding them with painful photophobia. And then the sharks came. A seaman swimming for a floating crate of potatoes thrashed in the water and was gone. Elemental terror. The men pressed together in their groups, some clusters deciding to beat the water, some to hang immobile as flotsam. A shark snapped away both the sailor's legs, and his unbalanced torso, suspended in its life jacket, flipped upside down. One survivor remembered counting 25 deadly attacks. The ship's doctor, in his larger group, counted 88. They won no rescue. They passed through Monday and Monday night and Tuesday night without water, sinking lower and lower in the sea as the Kapok and their life jackets waterlogged. Eventually, the thirst-crazed drank seawater. Those who drank became maniacal and thrashed violently, the doctor testifies, until the victims became comatose and drowned. The living were blinded by the sun. Their life jackets abraded their ulcerating skin. They burned with fever. They hallucinated. Wednesday and Wednesday night, the sharks circled and darted in to foray after flesh. Men in the grip of group delusions followed one swimmer to an island he thought he saw, another to the ghost of the ship, another down into the ocean depths, where fountains of fresh water seemed to promise to slake their thirst. All were lost. Fights broke out, and men slashed each other with knives. Saturated life jackets with waterlogged knots dragged other victims to their death. We became a mass of delirious, screaming men, says the doctor, grimly. Thursday morning, August 2nd, a Navy plane spotted the survivors. Because of negligence at Leyte, the Indianapolis had not yet even been missed. A major rescue effort began, ships steaming to the area, PBYs and PBMs dropping food and water and survival gear. The rescuers found 318 naked and emaciated men. The fresh water they drank, one of them remembers, tasted so sweet. It was the sweetest thing in your life. Through the 84-hour ordeal, more than 500 men had died, their bodies feeding sharks or lost to the depths of the sea. After making good his escape, submarine commander Hashimoto reminisces, "At length, on the 30th, we celebrated our haul of the previous day with our favorite rice with beans, boiled eels, and corned beef, all of it tinned. The day of the I-58's feast of canned goods, Carl Spots telexed Washington with news. Hiroshima, according to prisoner of war reports, is the only one of four target cities that does not have Allied prisoner of war camps. It was too late to reconsider targets, prisoners of war or not. Washington telexed back the next day. Targets assigned remain unchanged. However, if you consider your information reliable, Hiroshima should be given first priority among them. The die was cast. Once Trinity proved that the atomic bomb worked, men discovered reasons to use it. The most compelling reason Stimson stated in his Harper's Apologia in 1947, "My chief purpose was to end the war in victory with the least possible cost in the lives of the men in the armies which I helped to raise. In the light of the alternatives which, on a fair estimate, were open to us, I believe that no man in our position and subject to our responsibilities, holding in his hands a weapon of such possibilities for accomplishing this purpose and saving those lives, could have failed to use it, and afterwards looked his countrymen in the face." The scientific panel of the interim committee, Lawrence, Compton, Fermi, Oppenheimer, had been asked to conjure a demonstration of sufficient credibility to end the war. Meeting at Los Alamos on the weekend of June 16 through 17, debating long into the night, it found in the negative. Even Fermi's ingenuity was not sufficient to the task of devising a demonstration persuasive enough to decide the outcome of a long and bitter conflict. Recognizing our obligation to our nation to use the weapons to help save American lives in the Japanese war, the panel first surveyed the opinions of scientific colleagues, and then stated its own. Those who advocate a purely technical demonstration would wish to outlaw the use of atomic weapons, and have feared that if we use the weapons now, our position in future negotiations will be prejudiced. Others emphasize the opportunity of saving American lives by immediate military use, and believe that such use will improve the international prospects, in that they are more concerned with the prevention of war than with the elimination of this specific weapon. We find ourselves closer to these latter views. We can propose no technical demonstration likely to bring an end to the war. We see no acceptable alternative to direct military use. The bomb was to prove to the Japanese that the Potsdam Declaration meant business. It was to shock them to surrender. It was to put the Russians on notice and serve, in Stimson's words, as a badly needed equalizer. It was to let the world know what was coming. Leo Szilard had dallied with that rationale in 1944 before concluding in 1945, on moral grounds, that the bomb should not be used, and on political grounds, that it should be kept secret. Teller revived a variant rationale in early July 1945 in replying to Szilard about a petition Szilard was then circulating among Manhattan Project scientists protesting the bomb's impending use. First of all, let me say that I have no hope of clearing my conscience. The things we are working on are so terrible that no amount of protesting or fiddling with politics will save our souls. But I'm not really convinced of your objections. I do not feel that there is any chance to outlaw any one weapon. If we have a slim chance of survival, it lies in the possibility to get rid of wars. The more decisive the weapon is, the more surely it will be used in any real conflicts, and no agreements will help. Our only hope is in getting the facts of our results before the people. This might help to convince everybody that the next war would be fatal. For this purpose, actual combat use might even be the best thing. The bomb was also to be used to pay for itself, to justify to Congress the investment of $2 billion, to keep Groves and Stimson out of Leavenworth Prison. To avert a vast, indefinite butchery, Winston Churchill summarizes in his History of the Second World War, to bring the war to an end, to give peace to the world, to lay healing hands upon its tortured peoples by a manifestation of overwhelming power at the cost of a few explosions, seemed, after all our toils and perils, a miracle of deliverance. The few explosions did not seem a miracle of deliverance to the civilians of the enemy cities upon whom the bombs would be dropped. In their behalf, surely they have claim, something more might be said about reasons. The bombs were authorized not because the Japanese refused to surrender, but because they refused to surrender unconditionally. The debacle of conditional peace following the First World War led to the demand for unconditional surrender in the second, the earlier conflict casting its dark shadow down the years. It was the insistence on unconditional surrender that was the root of all evil, writes the Oxford moralist G.E.M. Anscombe in a 1957 pamphlet opposing the awarding of an honorary degree to Harry Truman. The connection between such a demand and the need to use the most ferocious methods of warfare will be obvious. And, in itself, the proposal of an unlimited objective in war is stupid and barbarous. As before in the Great War, for every belligerent, that was what the Second World War had become, stupid and barbarous. For men to choose to kill the innocent as a means to their ends, Anscombe adds bluntly, is always murder, and murder is one of the worst of human actions. In the bombing of Japanese cities, it was certainly decided to kill the innocent as a means to an end. In the decision of the Japanese militarists to arm the Japanese people with bamboo spears and set them against a major invasion force to fight to the death to preserve the homeland, it was certainly decided to kill the innocent as a means to an end as well. The barbarism was not confined to the combatants or the general staffs. It came to permeate civilian life in every country. In Germany and Japan, in Britain, in Russia, certainly in the United States. It was perhaps the ultimate reason Jimmy Burns, the politician's politician, and Harry Truman, the man of the people, felt free to use and compelled to use a new weapon of mass destruction on civilians in undefended cities. It was the psychology of the American people, I.I. Robbie eventually decided. I'm not justifying it on military grounds, but on the existence of this mood of the military with the backing of the American people. The mood, suggests the historian Herbert Feiss, encompassed impatience to end the strain of war, blended with a zest for victory. They longed to be done with smashing, burning, killing, dying, and were angry at the defiant, crazed useless prolongation of the ordeal. In 1945, Life magazine was the preeminent general circulation magazine in the United States. It served millions of American families for news and entertainment, as much as television a decade later began to do. Children read it avidly and reported on its contents in school. In the last issue of Life before the United States used the atomic bomb, a one-page picture story appeared, titled, in 48-point capitals, A Jap Burns. Its brief text, for those who could tear their eyes away from the 6 postcard-sized black-and-white photographs showing a man being burned alive long enough to read the words, savored horror while complaining of ugly necessity. When the 7th Australian Division landed near Balikpapan on the island of Borneo last month, they found a town strongly defended by Japanese. As usual, the enemy fought from caves, from pillboxes, from every available hiding place. And as usual, there was only one way to advance against them. Burn them out. Men of the 7th, who had fought the Japs before, quickly applied their flamethrowers, soon convinced some Japs that it was time to quit. Others, like the one shown here, refused. So they had to be burned out. Although men have fought one another with fire from time immemorial, the flamethrower is easily the most cruel, the most terrifying weapon ever developed. If it does not suffocate the enemy in his hiding place, its quickly licking tongues of flame sear his body to a black crisp. But so long as the Jap refuses to come out of his holes and keeps killing, this is the only way. In a single tabloid page, Life had assembled a brutal allegory of the later course of the Pacific War. Little Boy was ready on July 31st. It lacked only its 4 sections of cordite charge, a precaution prepared when the weapon was designed at Los Alamos, but decided upon at Tinian, for safety on takeoff, and in the event visual bombing proved impossible, in which case Tibbetts had orders to bring the bomb back. 3 of Tibbetts' full complement of 15 B-29s flew a last test that day of July with a dummy Little Boy. They took off from Tinian, rendezvoused over Iwo Jima, returned to Tinian, dropped Unit L-6 into the sea, and practiced their daredevil diving turn. With the completion of this test, writes Norman Ramsey, all tests preliminary to combat delivery of a Little Boy with active material were completed. That unit would be number L-11, and the sturdy tungsten steel target holder screwed to its muzzle, the best in stock, was the first one Los Alamos had received. It had served 4 times for firing tests at Anchor Ranch late in 1944, before being packed in Cosmoline for the voyage out to Tinian. Since everything was ready, Farrell telexed Groves to report that the mission could be flown on August 1st. He would assume that the Spots directive of July 25th authorized such initiative unless Groves replied to the contrary. The commanding general of the Manhattan Project let his deputy's interpretation stand. Little Boy would have flown on August 1st if a typhoon had not approached Japan that day to intervene. So the mission waited on the weather. On August 2nd, Thursday, the 3 B-29s that carried Fat Man pre-assemblies arrived from New Mexico. The assembly team of Los Alamos scientists and military ordnance technicians went to work immediately to prepare 1 Fat Man for a drop test and a 2nd with higher quality HE castings for combat. The 3rd pre-assembly would be held in reserve for the plutonium core scheduled to be shipped from Los Alamos in mid-August. By August 3rd, recalls Paul Tibbetts, we were watching the weather and comparing it to the long-range forecast. The actual and forecast weather were almost identical, so we got busy. Among other necessities, getting busy involved briefing the crews of the 7 509th B-29s that would fly the first mission for weather reporting, observation, and bombing. Tibbetts scheduled the briefing for 1,500 hours on August 4th. The crews arrived between 1,400 and 1,500 to find the briefing hut completely surrounded by MPs armed with carbines. Tibbetts walked in promptly at 1,500. He had just returned from checking out the aircraft he intended to use to deliver Little Boy, usually piloted by Robert Lewis, B-29 number 82, as yet unnamed. Deke Parsons joined him on the briefing platform. A radio operator, Sergeant Abe Spitzer, kept an illegal diary of his experiences at Tinian that described the briefing. "The moment had arrived," Tibbetts told the assembled crews. "The weapon they were about to deliver had recently been tested successfully in the United States. Now they were going to drop it on the enemy." Two intelligence officers undraped the blackboards behind the 509th commander to reveal aerial photographs of the targets: Hiroshima, Kokura, Nagasaki. Niigata was excluded, apparently, because of weather. Tibbetts named them and assigned three crews, finger crews, to fly ahead the day of the drop to assess their cloud cover. Two more aircraft would accompany him to photograph and observe. The seventh would wait beside a loading pit on Iwo Jima as a spare in case Tibbetts' plane malfunctioned. The 509th commander introduced Parsons, who wasted no words. He told the crews the bomb they were going to drop was something new in the history of warfare, the most destructive weapon ever made. It would probably almost totally destroy an area 3 miles across. They were stunned. "It is like some weird dream," Spitzer mused, "conceived by one with too vivid an imagination." Parsons prepared to show a motion picture of the Trinity test. The projector refused to start. Then it started abruptly and began chewing up leader. Parsons told the projectionist to shut the machine off and improvised. He described the shot in the Jornada del Muerto, how far away the light had been seen, how far away the explosion had been heard, the effects of the blast wave, the formation of the mushroom cloud. He did not identify the source of the weapon's energy, but with details, a man knocked down at 10,000 yards, men 10 and 20 miles away temporarily blinded. He won their rapt attention. Tibbetts took over again. They were now the hottest crews in the Air Force, he warned them. He forbade them to write letters home or to discuss the mission even among themselves. He briefed them on the flight. It would probably go, he said, early on the morning of August 6th. An Air Sea rescue officer described rescue operations. Tibbetts closed with a challenge, a final word Spitzer paraphrases in his diary. The colonel began by saying that whatever any of us, including himself, had done before was small potatoes compared to what we were going to do now. Then he said the usual things, but he said them well, as if he meant them, about how proud he was to have been associated with us, about how high our morale had been, and how difficult it was not knowing what we were doing, thinking maybe we were wasting our time and that the gimmick was just somebody's wild dream. He was personally honored, and he was sure all of us were, to have been chosen to take part in this raid, which, he said, and all the other bigwigs nodded when he said it, would shorten the war by at least 6 months. And you got the feeling that he really thought this bomb would end the war. Period. The following morning, Sunday, Guam reported that weather over the target cities should improve the next day. At 1400 on August 5, Norman Ramsey records, General LeMay officially confirmed that the mission would take place on August 6. That afternoon, the loading crew winched Little Boy onto its sturdy transport dolly, draped it with a tarpaulin to protect it from prying eyes. There were still Japanese soldiers hiding out on the island, hunted at night by security forces like raccoons, and wheeled it to one of the 13-by-16-foot loading pits Kirkpatrick had prepared. A battery of photographers followed along to record the proceedings. The dolly was wheeled over the 9-foot pit on its tracks. The hydraulic lift came up to relieve it of its bomb and detachable cradle. The crew wheeled the dolly away, removed the tracks, rotated the bomb 90 degrees, and lowered it into the pit. The world's first combat atomic bomb looked like an elongated trash can with fins, one of Tibbetts' crew members thought, with its tapered tail assembly that culminated in a boxed frame of stabilizing baffle plates. It was 10.5 feet long and 29 inches in diameter. It weighed 9,700 pounds, an armored cylinder jacketed in blackened dull steel with a flat, rounded nose. A triple fusing system armed it. The main fusing component was a radar unit, adapted from a tail warning mechanism developed to alert combat pilots when enemy aircraft approached from behind. This radar device, notes the Los Alamos Technical History, would close a relay, that is, a switch, at a predetermined altitude above the target. For reliability, Little Boy and Fat Man each carried four such radar units, called Archies. Rather than an approaching enemy aircraft, the bomb Archies would bounce their signals off the approaching enemy ground. An agreed reading by any two of the units would send a firing signal into the next stage of the fusing system, the technical history explains. This stage consisted of a bank of clock-operated switches, started by arming wires, which were pulled out of the clocks when the bomb dropped from the plane's bomb bay. These clock switches were not closed until 15 seconds after the bomb was released. Their purpose was to prevent detonation in the case the Archie units were fired by signals reflected from the plane. A second arming device was a barometric pressure switch, which did not close until subject to a pressure corresponding to 7,000 feet altitude. Once it passed through the clock and barometric arming devices, the Little Boy firing signal went directly to the primers that lit the cordite charges to fire the gun. Externally, the fusing system revealed itself in trailing whips of radar antenna, clock wires threaded into holes in the weapon's upper waist and holes in its tapered tail assembly that admitted external air to guarantee accurate barometry. Loading the bomb was delicate. The fit was tight. A ground crew towed the B-29 to a position beside the loading pit, running onto a turntable the main landing gear on the wing nearer the pit. Towing the aircraft around on the turntable through 180 degrees positioned it over the pit. The hydraulic lift raised Little Boy to a point directly below the open bomb doors. A plumb bob hung from the single bomb shackle for a point of reference, and jacks built into the bomb cradle allowed the crew to line up the bomb eye. "The operation can be accomplished in 20 to 25 minutes, a Boeing engineer commented in an August report, "but it is a rather ticklish procedure, as there is very little clearance with the catwalks, and, once installed, nothing holds the bomb but the single shackle and adjustable sway braces bearing on it." Though he flew it as his own, Robert Lewis had never named B-29 number 82. The day of the loading, Tibbetts consulted the officers in Lewis's crew, but not Lewis, and did so. The 509th commander chose not pinups or puns, but his mother's given names, Enola Gay, because she had assured him he would not be killed flying when he fought out with his father his decision to become a pilot. "Through the years," Tibbetts told an interviewer once, "whenever I got in a tight spot in a plane, I always remembered her calm assurance. It helped. In getting ready for the big one, I rarely thought of what might happen, but when I did, those words of Mom's put an end to it." He wrote a note on a slip of paper, located a sign painter among the service personnel, the man had to be dragged away from a softball game, and told him to paint that on the strike ship, nice and big. Foot-high, squared brushstrokes went on at a 30-degree angle beneath the pilot's window of the bullet-nosed plane, the middle name flush right below the first. Lewis, a sturdy, combative 200-pounder, had known for a day or two that Tibbetts would pilot the mission. A disappointment, but still considered the special